Okay, welcome everybody, and thanks for joining us this evening, and making my maiden journey into the world of webcast shiurim more pleasurable. I'd love to thank Rabbi Jay Kelman and the entire Torah in Motion team for taking advantage of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's bracha to us, of the technology that he's made available. Every bracha that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us should be applied for his honor, and Torah in Motion is doing just that by allowing sometimes quality shiurim to be broadcast to the world at large and link people on all different continents at the same time. For those of you who joined late, please send your email to tech support and make sure that you have the text sheets in front of you. We are going to be doing text the hard way. Let me start. I have long been a lover of Maral of Prague. Personally, I got my start with Maral through Rav Aryeh Kaplan Zatzal. I was reluctant, like most other yeshiva people at the time, to wade into the world of Maral. Rav Aryeh Kaplan held my hand and gave me a couple of pointers and took off the training wheels and had me speed down the street. And I've been peddling ever since and hope to share the same kind of enthusiasm and some of the skills with people who are tuning in these 4 weeks. I published one major work on Maral, Be'er HaGola, which is the Maral's collection of the hardest, passages in Agada. It was published about 8 years ago by Artsco, and if you like what we do tonight, you may find something of value in that sefer. Let's start by looking briefly at Agada, which is what the Maral is linked to more than anything else. We know that Agada amounts to approximately one-third of Shas Bavli. In many places, when people learn Gemara textually, people sort of put their minds in neutral and speed through Agada, because often Agada is so obscure, so difficult to penetrate, that people give up and don't even try. At the same time, virtually anyone who's written anything of quality over the last 1,000 years, who made any statement about what Judaism purports to say about anything, ultimately is grounded in Agada. As back as far as the time of Rambam, and really before in the time of the Gaonim, there were different approaches to Agada. By Agada, I mean the non-strictly legal parts of Shas. By Agada, I mean the parts of the Gemara that deal with history, with philosophy, with short aphorisms, with long stories, that don't seem to be interested in getting you to a fixed point that that demands a particular kind of fixed halachic response. In the time of the Rambam already, the attitudes towards Agada were so different that the Rambam wrote about three groups that he saw in his day. One group of people looked at Agada and found passages that made absolutely no sense to them, that seemed so obscure, so over the top and off the wall, that they literally said, if this is what Torah wants me to believe, I want no part of it, and essentially just closed the book. Interestingly enough, he said that attitude was found primarily among physicians in his day, who I think we recognize were the intelligentsia of his lifetime. Another group at the opposite end of the spectrum argued that if this is in Shas Bavli, it's part of Heilige Torah. This is our holy Torah. It's Torah Shebaal Peh. And who am I, puny, mortal, flesh and blood, to question what is part of our Torah? If this is there in Shas or in Midrashim, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to believe it. And I will champion, I will embrace it, and I will shout it from the rooftops. The Rambam writes, that the first group of people performed exactly like Chazal wanted them to. Chazal disguised their profundity and their depth in such ways that those who really did not have the spiritual gumption, the emunas chachamim, the staying power, would close the book and walk away. And that's exactly what they wanted. They didn't want all of their profundity shared with everyone. The second group that insisted on a literalist approach to Agada were trying to do the Ribbono Shel Olam a favor. But he said, instead of doing HaKadosh Baruch Hu a favor by resorting to literalism, whereas the Torah tells us in Devarim that the nations of the world will say, Rak Am Chacham V'Navon Hagoy HaGadol Hazeh, what a great and understanding nation this wonderful people is. Rather than that, when people see Jews repeating literally things in the Gemara without understanding their deeper meaning, the reaction of the nations of the world, and sometimes of our own, is Rak Am Sochal V'Navol Hagoy HaKaton Hazeh. What a foolish people this small people is. So the Rambam says there's a third group, and that's the group I identify with. This group has been impressed by the depth of Torah, by the incredible profundity of it in halachic areas. And they note that the people who contributed to Agada were, in many cases, the same people, the same Abaya and Rava, that they broke their heads over understanding a line of Gemara here and there. And they realized that these people are not capable of generating sheer foolishness. And there must be keys that we have not yet gotten hold of that will unlock the secrets. Unfortunately, he says, they're only a minority of people in this school, but that's the school of thought that he identifies with. I think it might be the best introduction to morale to say that the morale, more than anyone else, is one who conveyed those tools to people to unlock ways in which we could take passages of Agada that we have difficulty understanding, and even those that we think we understand, and expose multiple levels of meaning and beauty and profundity where other people would only mock. Rav Shmuel HaNagid, a few hundred years before the Rambam, wrote, it's printed in the back of Gemara Brachos in the standard edition, that Ein Lemedin Minha Agada Ela Masha Ola Al Hadas. You only learn from Agada what ultimately is reasonable. Rav Eliyahu Dessler, certainly not a liberal thinker, one of the most traditional modern thinkers we have, in the fourth volume on page 354 says that Agada must be understood. And if you come across a passage in Agada and the interpretation that you seize upon doesn't really strike home, doesn't really make any sense to you, then you can't learn from it because you've got it wrong. If you really grasped it properly, it would make eminent sense. The Moral himself lived between the end of the 16th and the early 17th century. I probably need to apologize to him for saying this, but for those of us who spent too much time in high school English, the best way that people will remember when the Moral wrote most of his important works is to recall Lahavdil when Shakespeare wrote his histories. That last decade of the 16th century was really the decade of the most important output of the Moral Sfarim. It was a time that winds of change were blowing already through the Jewish world. In the nearby Italian city-states, Talmidei Chachamim were writing poetry, were drinking of the wells of secular society. There were some relative free thinkers around who were beginning to question rabbinic tradition. Maral proved to be the great defender of the faith. He managed in the course of his lifetime to take classical philosophy, which still was playing out in much of Jewish life, to take that, to take Kabbalah, with which he was very well versed in, and united them all. In addition, he united some of the new trends of modernity. The famous Dutch astronomer, Tycho Brahe, spent 1 year at the University of Prague, had an appointment, and in his diary, he lamented the year that he spent there. He said there was no one to talk to. No one understood the cutting-edge astronomy that he was into, except for the old rabbi with whom he had many a pleasurable conversation. He understood what he was up to. The Maral proved to be the great defender of Chazal because he had more emunas chachamim. He knew that there had to be a profound message in every line, and therefore he was able to see it, to look for it a little bit more, and to find that beauty and profundity. He is perhaps Agada's greatest explicator. He was not immediately picked up by the masses. His language is difficult. It remains a barrier to many people today. But like many other great Sfarim, when you get used to his style, you put in the effort and eventually you unlock the key to understanding how to navigate his difficult style, his idiosyncratic terminology. Like everything else in Torah, Yagatiyu Matsasi Tamin. If we put in the effort, we will find at least some of the beauty in his works. Let me give you a brief roadmap of what we're going to do in these 4 weeks and then immediately get to work with text itself. I hope in the space of these four shiurim, each one will go approximately 45-50 minutes and then leave some time for interactive questions. I hope to show you different kinds of Agadah, different kinds of contribution that the Maral makes. Some of them are short, pithy clarifications, sometimes that will provide keys for understanding many similar passages in the Agada. We will take some look at the Maral's numerology. It is one of his trademarks of attaching definite significance to particular numbers. We will look at his insistence on structure and order. Alone among Mechabrim that I can think of, Maral insists almost always when there are three or four or five different Tanoim or Amoroyim who weigh in one passage, he sees even the order in which they're presented as significant and joins them in a common thread. We will probably do a passage where he applies the same kind of thinking to Aseres HaDibros itself, turning all of the Ten Commandments into one solitary theme. Tonight, though, I picked two passages just because of the joy I hope they will bring you, just because they are enlightening and joyful to go through. So I ask you to turn to your sheets and to look at the first of the two sections that I've provided you. This is from Nesivos Olam. In the common printing today, there are two volumes on different midos. Each one gets a different perek. We're going to look at the second perek in Nesivos Olam, a treatment of a passage in the Agada that certainly most of our listeners have seen many times before, And I hope that the passage has troubled you. Here we go. We're going to read this in the original Hebrew. If you don't understand Hebrew, relax. You should be able to pick up about 90% from my translation. If there are any questions, please bring me back home at the end of the broadcast, and I'll try to undo the damage that I've done then. Here we go, if I can find the screen on my computer. The Perek B'Memad Likin. Second Perek of Shabbos, Daf Lamed Aleph Amid Aleph. You've heard this before. V'hoya emunas itecha chosein yeshuos chachma v'das yiras Hashem hi otsro. This is a pasuk from Yeshaya, Perek Lamed Gimel, chapter 33, verse 6. Roughly, the faith of your times will be the strength of your salvations. Wisdom and knowledge, fear of Hashem, this is a person's treasure. The Gemara in Shabbos takes each one of the phrases, parses the verse, and links it first to a different one of the six Sidrei Mishnah, the six major sections of Mishnah. Then it turns to a completely different interpretation. It sees in this a plug for Yiras Hashem, which is the topic that the Maral is dealing with. This is in the second parak of Shav Nesiv Yiras Hashem. Let me read it to you. Amar Rava, B'shar Shemach Nisim Ha'adam Ledin. When a person is brought in for judgment, we're talking about the time after 120 years, a person wakes up and realizes that he or she is no longer alive. They're brought before the Kisei HaKavod, the heavenly throne for judgment. Person stands there petrified, shivering. And we've heard this before. They ask you six questions. Everyone has heard the first question. The first question they ask you is, how much integrity did you bring to your business dealings? Okay? Every Rav who's dealt with Choshen Mishpat issues in Shul has referenced this Gemara at some time. But let's do the whole Gemara. B'shar shemachnisim hadam ledin. When a person is ushered into his judgment, omrim lo, they say to him, nasasa v'nasata b'amuna? Did you deal with integrity? Did you deal honestly in your business activities? Question number one. Question number two. Kavata itim l'Torah? Did you set time aside for the learning of Torah? Osakta b'pirya v'rivya? Did you engage in procreation? Sipisa l'Yeshua? Did you yearn for salvation? Pilpalta b'chachma? Did you engross yourself deeply in wisdom? Hevanta davar mitoch davar? Did you try to understand new ideas from old ones? That's the list. Six questions asked. Even if you answer all of them affirmatively, v'afilu hachi, referencing the last part of the pasuk in Yeshaya, the last part of the verse, Yiras Hashem hi otsro, if Yiras Shemayim, reverence for Hashem, was a person's treasure house, in, then he makes it ilo lo, and if not, not. Moshe la'adam sha'amar l'shlucho. This is analogous to a person who speaks to his worker, his farm worker, and says, Hello lichitim la'aliya. Did you bring all of my wheat crop into the barn and the silo for storage? The halalo, he brings it in, amalo. Then he asks him as an afterthought, a raftabo kav chumtin. Did you remember, before sealing up the silo, to blend in a small measure of preservative? Amalei lav? He said, no, I forgot, amalei mutov. It would have been better had you not brought the crop in altogether. Ad kan. That's the end of the Gemara. Ladies and gentlemen, what's wrong with this picture? I have tried asking crowds, both Jewish and non-Jewish, about the premise of the Gemara. What do you suppose HaKadosh Baruch Hu asks people when they get to the other side? And, you know, people, depending on their background, say, I don't know, name, rank, serial number. Some people respond with the three cardinal sins of Judaism. Did you violate the three big ones? Others argue, did you keep kosher? Did you keep Shabbos? Did you remember to send your check into UJA once a year? Things that are obvious to people. Where does the Gemara come up with such a motley group of questions as the somehow the most significant things that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can ask of a person? Furthermore, look at those questions, even if you can come up with a defense for some of them. Take a look at number two. We understand the centrality of Torah and Torah study, but that's not the question. The question posed to the person is not, so how many volumes of art school did you make it through? How much of it did you remember? How much of an impression did it make upon you? The question simply is, did you set time aside for it? No question about what was actually retained or what was learned. It seems that the time involved was important. That's the crucial question. The third question seems to have to do with having children. We could understand if the question was, did you raise a generation of children, two generations, children and grandchildren, faithful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? But that's not the question. The question is, did you make the attempt at procreation? A couple that Rahmanul Islam tried and tried and wasn't Zocha, didn't merit to have children, passes this question. While others may fail. Tzipisa Yeshua, did you yearn for redemption? We would think that the question was, did you bring Mashiach one step closer? Did you make your contribution to universal salvation? But that's not the question. The question isn't, did you make your contribution to bringing utopia on earth? It was, did you simply yearn for it? Did it bother you that we weren't there? Did you sing Ani Mamin with gusto? The question isn't what kind of contribution you made to a better world. Let's see what the Maharal manages to do with all of these questions. So back to the text. Bi'aru b'zeh malas hayira. The thrust of this passage is, by the time we get to the end of it, to show the importance of Yiras Hashem. That happens only after we get through all six questions, and here today we're only probably going to do three or four. Da ki adin im hoya ha'adam hanhagaso kasher hoya ro'ulo mashenivra ba'adam haneshama min ha'elyonim. Know this, says Mara, that the judgment that a person is ushered into is not an examination primarily of every second of his or her life. The judgment is more like a true-false question, not an essay. It's whether the person, in his dealings, treated his neshama properly, whether his behavior in this world was consistent of one who was aware of having not only a soul, but a soul sourced in the upper worlds. A soul that came, Nishamayim, that came from the heavens. Ulekach tchilas dino nasasa v'nasata v'yamuna. Therefore, says the Maharal, it makes perfect sense that the first question put to a person should be, did you deal with integrity in the business world? Ki ha'elyonim ein echad mekabel mizulaso. You'll have to bear with me, ladies and gentlemen, this is not an easy concept. Morale often isn't. He talks about elyonim. You understand that elyonim means the denizens of the upper worlds. I don't know about you out there. I've never met a malach personally. we can only imagine what a malach is. I suspect that we couldn't see one if we encountered one because they have no physical properties, which is precisely Maral's point. A malach, despite all of the medieval church art we may have seen, is not something flying around with wings and a halo and a harp. A malach has to be closer to what the Rambam describes it as. Something, some entity that HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates to get something done. It doesn't share the properties that we're comfortable with. It doesn't have time and space and boundary and limitation. Let me belabor the point, if you will, to the point of absurdity, just to make the point. Imagine two malachim, two angels, standing at the heavenly bus stop, ready to make a trip down to Kansas to make the wheat grow more proudly and firmly in a given growing season. One malach turns to the other as he sees the bus rounding the turn and says, "Oh, I can't believe this. I left my wallet home. You mind lending me $10 for the trip? I'll pay you back when we get back here in a couple of months." Okay, malachim don't take buses, we understand that. But beyond that, if you'll bear with me in the analogy, what's really wrong with this is, at least in Maral's reading, is that an angel will never have to borrow anything from anything else. Because a malach, an angel, is created for a mission, created to do a job, and created completely with the wherewithal to do the Ratzon Hashem, to do whatever it is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu empowers it, asks it to do. It has no lack. It has no deficiency. Now, the Maral says that if a person is conscious of having a neshama, a person essentially has to ask himself or herself throughout their lifetime one question. I am conscious of being an amalgam of two different parts. I share physical properties with everything on the face of the earth, but I am possessed of a neshama that comes from a different place. How do I self-define chiefly? Do I see myself as an angelic being, as striving to be, as honoring and identifying with the part of myself that comes from the upper worlds, or do I see myself as a more creatively packaged a group of protoplasm? This is the question asked of the person. If you identify primarily with the angelic, if it occupies a key part in your thinking, you will try to be as much as possible like the malachim. The Maral goes on to say that malachim never have to take from anything else. They are never deficient. They never lack what they need. Human beings, alas, cannot be angels. We can be angelic, but we can't be angels. We always have to take. We have to breathe, we have to eat, we have to drink, we have to have discourse with other human beings. But, says the Maral, if you're conscious of the angelic within you, if that's the pole within you, of the two poles that you strive to identify with, then as much as possible, you will try to run your life with the angelic as the model in front of you. As much as possible, you will not have to take from outside of you. We can't be angels to take nothing, but at least we can take only what is appropriate to us, not taking what belongs to someone else, not taking what is inappropriate to us. The way we do business is a sign of consciously or subconsciously which part of ourselves we most identify with. Let's go down a couple of lines to where he picks up the next question. Before we get there, he points out in the lines that we're going to skip that don't think that the questions that are asked of a person should be, did you violate the three cardinal sins of Judaism, idolatry and illicit relations and murder? Because that's not what it's about. The judgment of a person should begin with a person's self-definition to see whether the person departed from the key motif that is expected of him. That motif is identifying with the Neshama Elyona. There'll be lots of time to get to all of the details, to review 120 years of history of a person's life. But the first course question that is asked is, how did you see yourself? Are you from our world, or are you still from the other world? The next question, did you set time aside for the study of Torah? We questioned before, shouldn't the question be, how much Torah did you learn? How much did you retain? How much of an impact did it have upon you? No, says the Maral. The question here again is, did you identify with the Elyonim, with the denizens of heaven? As physical beings, none of us ever conveniently forgot to eat for 3 days in a row. We couldn't. Our stomach won't allow us to. We're very much in touch with our physical being. We know its needs. Some of us take multivitamins every day to make sure that we get the minimum dose of vitamins whose chemical agents, whose chemical names we couldn't pronounce. The next question of the six is, did you understand that as a spiritual being, your neshama also had to be fed? Did you take the time every day to try to feed your neshama? Did you read the owner's manual of your neshama? Did you understand that the spiritual being within you, your neshama also needs nourishment? Did you provide at least the possibility of meals for your neshama the same way that you had cutlery in your kitchen drawers and plates in the cabinetry? Did you have svarim on your shelf from which you could take spiritual nourishment? We go down a few lines, if I can find it, to where he picks up with Pru or Vu. Perhaps to save time, I'll allow you to go through it in the text by yourself. I do want to get to the second piece tonight. He argues that Pru or Vu also follows the same theme, because angelic entities, Elyonim, creatures of the upper world, are never individuals in the true sense. They are entities that fit in seamlessly with a bigger picture. They start and stop without defined boundaries because they have no real identity save as part of a vast mechanism that operates without internal division. Human beings, to the contrary, are very much aware of our own boundaries, of where we start and where others start. We're aware of dimensions. We're aware of limitations. We're also aware that in our consciousness, we want to be a part of something bigger. Says the Maral, the test of whether a human being seeks to be like the angelic, seeks to be part of the whole rather than a plot, rather than a single individual, is to create a chain of identity to at least merge with human history. And he does that by striving to procreate. The question is not about the quality of your children or even whether you have them. It's only whether you try to take something that all biological and organisms do. Rabbits have no trouble procreating, but human beings have a seichel that will allow them to look at procreation in a very different way. This is our opportunity to become part of a bigger picture, to make the transition from prat of individual or two individuals and become part of klal. That is why procreation should be so important to us. Those who try to procreate and don't have children, or those who have children and the children don't turn out to be the way they want them to be, still cherished that angelic part of themselves. For the sake of giving you a taste of another piece, I'm going to skip the last three. Perhaps we'll be able to come back to them in the question period and try to move on to another completely different source. Before that, just the punchline of the Gemara. All six of the questions, as different as they appeared to us before we started the Gemara, Maral unites with one theme. This is so typical of him, to take different responses in a list and unite them under one rubric. In this case, the rubric is self-identification as a part of the Elyonim. Did I see myself as a neshama person more than a behema person, more than a chumri person, more than a material person? Which part of myself did I value more? The answer to all six of them will turn on that same single question, the six facets of one question. How did I see myself in this world? Nonetheless, says the Maral, the conclusion of the Gemara is, no matter how you saw yourself and how you valued your spiritual source, if you didn't couple all of that spiritual self-identity and striving with Yiras Shamayim, with a sense of the difference between your spirituality and the source from which it came, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who is the source of our being and the one to whom we have to answer, if we didn't have that reverence and awe for him, none of the above questions will really get us any place. It's like harvesting the entire crop and putting it in a place for safeguarding and allowing it to be eaten away because we haven't added the preservative. Let us quickly turn to the other source in the sheets in front of you. This one is timely. You've heard it before. Gemara and Megillah, that when the king Ahasuerus summoned Vashti to appear before him at the Suda, Vashti balked. That refusal ultimately cost her life. Why did she refuse? Well, imagine this scene. You've invited folks from the office to join you for a Shabbos dinner. You'd like to show off the beauty of the Shabbos. And the couple that you've invited are ultra-secular, never participated in the Shabbos before, skeptics, they call themselves agnostics, but you're starting to see that they're at least open to discussion. It took you 6 months to get them to the table. You get them there, everything is set, the table looks beautiful, your kids are resplendent, shiny, as is everything on the table. You go through Shalom Aleichem and Eishes Chayil and Kiddush, serve the first course and the second course, and you get to the inevitable ritual of Parsha questions, of asking children at the table the questions whose answers they rehearsed well in school for the last 3 days so their parents would be assured that they're paying tuition for a good reason. It happens to be the Shabbos before Purim. So you're going through the sheets, and then one child answers the first question properly, the second question, and then you read the third question, the words escape your lips, and you realize you've just lost the couple that you invited, because The question you asked them was, okay, Kindleach, children, why did Vashti refuse to appear naked at the lavish feast of the king? And three of your children jump out of their seats and all respond with the answer that they've heard in school. Because she grew a tail. And you stare down at your shoes, not wanting to look at the couple sitting across the table from you, wondering how you're going to get out of this one. Here you took a story which they certainly knew about, the story of Esther. It's a great story, not too hard for agnostics to deal with. The name of God doesn't appear once in the whole Megillah, and you've now turned it into an unbelievable, at least to a skeptic, fairy tale. What was wrong with the text before the rabbis got to it? Why do they have to place a tale upon Vashti? So let's look at the highlighted part of the reading that I have for you here, and get straight to the answer. Maral says, Pirish Zonov Hanemark Bakan, the explanation of the tale that is mentioned here, Sha'asolo Malach Kvedas Hateva, what the Malach, the angel sent by Hashem, who is invisible in the story itself, but we Ma'aminim understand that all the events in this Megillah were engineered by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to bring the salvation of the Jewish people. There was something at work over here to make Vashti suffer from Kvedas Hateva. The closest I can get to that is lethargic. She found herself uncharacteristically lethargic, perhaps bloated. This was something that happened to her, unexpectedly. And the Maral defends this reading by noting, Ki hazonav hi kveinas habachai, dehi tostos hanigrar achal habachai. Think of what a tale is. It seems to be, for most of the activity, even of animals, certainly in a human being, a superfluous bit of tissue trailing behind a person. Monkeys, I imagine, after a while, can learn to use their tails effectively. If we woke up on a Shabbos morning having sprouted a tail, we would be hard-pressed to do anything constructive with it. We would try to tie it up as best as we could and put it behind us in our loosest-fitting pair of pants and skirt before we could get to the emergency room after Shabbos. The tail would do us no good at all. It is a beautiful image for a useless appendage. Indeed, in the English language, when we try to talk about somebody who's gained 10 pounds, what do we call it? Spare tire. It's the same image transported into the automotive era. It's something that doesn't function, at least not immediately, is dead weight. The Maral says that the zonav, the tail, is nothing other than a weightiness that suddenly overcame Vashti. Why? We can only speculate. We know that Megillas Esther is not about Nisim Guyim, about dramatic acts of divine intervention with a hand reaching down from heaven and splitting the sea. Everything is quietly and in the background, but it is still HaKadosh Baruch Hu engineering and orchestrating things. I would speculate, just playfully, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu arranged for someone to FedEx Vashti a 10-pound box of her favorite chocolates the day before. Vashti, being low in self-control that day, managed to eat the better part of the box, when she got on the royal scale that the next morning, she found indeed that she was 5 pounds overweight. Being somewhat vain to begin with, when the king asked her to come, her reaction was, "In my prime, no problem, but I am not going to appear 5 pounds overweight with a little bit of spare tire around the midriff." That was Vashti's tale. We've taken a minor chazal that to many of us seems inexplicable or worse, and turned it into something that is perfectly reasonable and rational. A reasonable and rational question you might ask, which I hope to get to in future weeks, is if that's what they meant, why didn't Chazal say so? Why did they couch their lesson in terms as so obscure that they had to be unlocked? Bezras Hashem, we will get there. What I think we should do at the moment, though, is take any questions you have had while you've been patiently watching. If there are no questions,
I have one. Zachiah.
Welcome.
I've been trying to read through some of his work in Hebrew, and I find the repetition more puzzling than what he's trying to say, and I even get less of what he says by the repetition. Why does he write in that style? And what does it mean to repeat so often?
So I have good news for you and bad news. The bad news is that question is asked by serious students of Maral more often than any other question that I've ever heard. The second part of the bad news is I have yet to find a person to come up with any answer, let alone a satisfactory answer to that question. There does seem to be repetition morale, at least to us in our generation, that cannot be accounted for. It's not like learning a Tosfos in Gemara or a Rashba where you know that if there's a line of repetition, it has its purpose. I don't know anybody who can account for it. I will tell you that if you want to make any progress through morale, here's the good news, you just have to drop that question. If you drop that question and don't deal with the repetition and just try to explicate the lines of his first reading of it, you'll eventually get a lot. I can't tell you it'll be 100%, but if you're stuck on the issue of the repetition, you'll never get anywhere in Mala.
Can I ask you a further question on that situation?
Sure.
Also, the language that he used, sometimes, like, let's say what we just saw now, like the heaviness of nature, Kvedat HaTeva, I mean, that's particular to him, because I didn't see that anywhere. So he uses sometime language, and I'm not so sure what does that refer to in our language ourselves.
Right, so I think in this case, Kvedat HaTeva is not meant idiosyncratically. I think the terminology, especially in the late 16th century, meant where people were still working with the old system of four humors, and sometimes people being weighed down by too much of an aggregation of one humor. That made perfect sense to everybody. Where you really hit the mark is that there are some parts of Maral's terminology, like Ola and Olol, Chomer and Surah, that can only be understood by jump-starting. You need to find someone who's been learning Maral for a couple of years and seen enough examples of that terminology that they have somewhat of a good sense, if not a perfect sense of what they mean, give you a partial understanding of them, and then progress from there on your own. I actually hope to do that with a few of those idiosyncratic terms in the next couple of weeks. But some of them are absolutely idiosyncratic to him, and unless you unlock their meaning, you can't understand dozens and dozens of passages. Chomer and Surah in particular, although anyone who's ever studied classic philosophy recognizes substance and form, Maral does not use them the way we learned them in our first year of college. He does have his own particularistic way of looking at it, but you do catch on after a while.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You look in the chat box, Rabbi, you'll see a question.
I'm starting to look. Can you recommend books or Sfarim to guide a beginner in Maral? Yes and no. There are a number of translations of books on Maral. Some of them are very good, some of them are passable, some of them are downright poor. I am not going to link those three descriptions with particular titles without an attorney at my side. But I'm a purist. I believe that the issue in studying Maral is not the translation. Of course, if you can't read it, you can't get anywhere. But I have a problem with translations of Maral the same way that I would have a problem of a translation of the Gemara without any notes at the bottom, whether it's Sansino or Art Scroll. If I have a problem with translating Midrashim without any commentary. Just translating them into the vernacular doesn't give you any assurance that you're going to come up with anything that makes any sense at all. I think that the study of Maral has to be a guided study. A translation has to be coupled with someone kind of taking a stab at what those words mean. I don't want to toot my own horn, and I'm not saying that it's a great work or even a passable work, but the only work that I know of on Maral that didn't translate but took a stab at trying to lock in a particular meaning is the Sefer I wrote on Be'er HaGola. So I don't want to be accused of self-promotion, but at the moment, I do believe that you'll find something valuable in the introduction. And perhaps, as I wrote in the introduction, when you look at a few chapters, you'll either love what you see or hate it. And if you hate it, it's just as fine with me, because it'll mean that you disagree with the way I've interpreted, and you'll come up with something better. The example that we just did is a good case in point. In some shir I gave at some point, I argued that Vashti gained a few pounds. And someone last year, very fine fellow, emailed me and said, is it true that you said that? Because I've gone back to the original, and he doesn't say anything about Vashti gaining a few pounds. He just says that she suffered from Kveda Sateva, which should be translated as lethargy, not gaining 5 pounds. Why do you translate that as gaining a few pounds? Hey, it sounds more dramatic, but maybe Adlerstein, you've been in Hollywood too long. So I explained that if you look at the words, it's true, the words don't say anything more than lethargy. But if you translate it that way, you're still begging the question, why was she lethargic? Did the lethargy just happen because the Malach stuck an idea in her head? Guess what, Vashti? Act like you're lethargic. Or was there something that happened, the derech hateva, in a natural way, like everything else in the Megillah, to make her lethargic? What makes us bloated? 90% of the time we feel bloated because we ate too much at the last meal. So I use that to defend my explication and indeed going beyond the words. But I think that in many other cases, if all you do is translate, you really don't get very far. You've maybe managed to inch out of the dugout, but you're not even at home plate yet. Forget about getting an infield fly first one bagger. Oops, I'm not supposed to say that to Canadians. Is the book readily available? Yeah, you can get it through Amazon and at the Art Scroll website. Any other questions?
Okay, Rabbi, we'll, it's 10:01 or 7:01 in L.A., but we'll let you go, and we'll see you next week, hopefully. And I want to thank you. I want to apologize for the beginning, the couple minutes of the technical difficulties. They are generally rare, and we'd like to hear your feedback, and thank you very much.